From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. This week, Americans are grieving another mass shooting of children and teachers at an elementary school. Tuesday night, hours after the massacre in Uvalde, Texas, the president compared gun violence in this country to others.
These kinds of mass shootings rarely happen anywhere else in the world. Why? They have mental health problems. They have domestic disputes in other countries. They have people who are lost. But these kinds of mass shootings never happen with the kind of frequency they happen in America. Why?
Let's hear now a perspective from someone who lives outside of the U.S. Journalist Maria Ressa joins us. She runs the Filipino news site Rappler. She has been a consistent target of the Filipino government for doing journalism, arrested twice last year, convicted of cyber libel. But she has stood firm among all this and last year was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her work. Maria Ressa, thank you so much for being here. It's a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
And I have a lot that I want to talk to you about, but why don't we start with the shooting in Texas? We heard President Biden there say this kind of violence rarely happens outside of the United States. How does news like this land at home in the Philippines and elsewhere?
As always, shock, but the same question, you know. And then I've been looking at our information ecosystem and looked at the extreme increased levels, exponential increase of violence. So I look at it in two ways. You know, the first is that we're pumping hate into our information ecosystem. It's triggering anger. And we've known this for many years now, that online violence is real-world violence. I mean, maybe not Uvalde, but if you take a look at Buffalo, he was in it, like the Christchurch shootings, which was many years ago, and there was a Christchurch call. This was sparked by online radicalization, right? So we begin there. And then, of course, the United States has its own. I mean, you have the meeting going on with the NRA right now. You have your bipartisan politics that's tearing you apart more than the polarization that we're experiencing online.
And yet many journalists working in the United States, I think, have become numb to some of this in a sense. So if you were running a newsroom in the United States with these fresh outside eyes, would you have a different approach to the coverage?
I would go to the root causes. So much of our coverage, and this is the same in every other part of the world, looks at the downstream effects. You know, like, for example, again, you'll talk about each of the violence, but you have to move further upstream. Where does it begin? And the easiest place, again, is that I think the spark to all of this is the online, this toxic sludge that is poisoning every one of us online, more than 3.2 billion now, right? Globally. And you have seen attacks increase, genocide in Myanmar. And so I move further up, right? I would look at the impact of technology, how technology polarizes and radicalizes, and then take a look. Strangely enough, I started in covering terrorism. And this is a different type of terrorism, but it's the same kind of pushing us to the extremes and emerging in real-world violence.
Let's take a look at your home country. You work and live in the Philippines. There has just been a landslide victory for Ferdinand Marcos Jr. This is the son of a brutal dictator by the same name who ruled the Philippines from 1965 to 1986. The legislature just confirmed his victory this week. Tell me, what was the feeling in your newsroom on election night?
We fell off the cliff 36 years after the People Power Revolt sparked democracy movements all around the world, after that family was ousted and chased to Hawaii, you know, he is back by an overwhelming mandate. And again, I'll go back. How did it begin? It begins in our minds. It begins. There's this great quote by Milan Kundera. He said, "The struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting." Well, disinformation, you know, as early as 2014, disinformation networks linked to the Marcoses began to shift our history in plain sight. And I
is
guess,
that how it's possible that someone so closely connected to a dictator would win an election in a landslide? I mean, that's what's so hard to grapple with here.
The namesake of the dictator, you know, a man who himself had to face charges. And actually, like India's Prime Minister Modi, he can't travel to the United States as an individual, but as a democratically elected head of state, now he can, right? So yes, definitely. This is, look, we fell off the cliff in 2022. I mean, in 2016, the election of Rodrigo Duterte was the beginning of the dominoes. That was the first of the dominoes to fall. It was followed shortly, like a month later, by Brexit. Then you had the elections all around the world. Catalonia, Donald Trump in November, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. So that was kind of the beginning of the rise of these autocratic populists. And then now with Marcos back, I think we fell off the cliff. And the question is, you know, it goes back to, how can we have elections? There are more than 30 of them. You will have elections, midterms in November. But how can you have elections if you don't have integrity of facts? That's the first question. And then the second question is the technology that is delivering the news to us. Facebook is the world's largest delivery platform for news. It actually, they put their thumb on the scale. And as early as 2018, we know that lies laced with anger and hate spreads faster and further than facts, which are really boring, no matter how wonderful your voice sounds. You know, it's like, it's, and so if you don't have facts, you can't have truth. If you don't have truth, you don't have trust. Without those, you don't have a shared reality where we can begin to think and solve problems together. You don't have democracy.
Exactly. So is the Philippines still a democracy?
Oh, that's a, I think TBD, right? You're going to, I mean, President-elect Marcos held a press conference, and I'm going to put that in quotes. If you look at the Rappler headlines, he invited only three, and I hesitate to say news groups, but, you know, one organization just recently got its franchise, and it is a religious network. So two of them are religious, one owned by a man, the pastor of Duterte, who is wanted by the FBI for sex trafficking. The second one is also a religious network. And the third is the most legitimate of those. So the rest of the news organizations just watched. No questions were asked about human rights violations, about the estimated $10 billion in 1980 dollars that the Marcos family were accused of stealing. Will this administration continue to run after that? Because only about $4 billion has been returned. I mean, there are so many tough questions. So, TBD, let's see what happens. But, you know, while I hope for the best, we also have to be ready for the worst.
We just have a few minutes left, and I want to get to Russia because you shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Dmitry Muratov, the editor-in-chief of a newspaper that had been critical of Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. It was forced to suspend operations because of the new laws restricting how the media in Russia can report on the invasion, the war in Ukraine, though they're not allowed to say that word. Muratov was attacked with chemicals. Can you understand his decision to suspend this paper until the war is over?
Absolutely. If you can't work as a journalist, then you whitewash, then you become, you sanitize the lack of democracy, right? So definitely, there comes a point when you can no longer be an independent journalist. And, you know, I hope my country doesn't go there. But, you know, I warn, starting in 2016, I began really telling Americans that what is happening to us is coming for you. We're only the beginning, right? As a former colony of the United States, the Philippines somehow has been the testing ground for attacks against America and its democracy. The 9/11 attacks were tested. Some of those tactics of getting through airport security were tested in the Philippines in 1994. That was my first really big story, tracking that network. And now, the attack on your minds and on your emotions. These, according to the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower, were tested in the Philippines. Facebook agreed we were ground zero. So where we go, you go. So please guard your democracy.
And thank you for helping us do that. Just briefly, do you have a threshold in your own, I don't know, like that you would reach where you say, you know what, it's time to shut down the Rappler?
When we can, yeah, absolutely. Like Dimitri, you know, it's going to be when we can no longer be independent journalists. And what is that? Dimitri said, I can't use the word war to describe a war, right? Look, to a small degree, American journalists have had to deal with this by, like, when President Trump lied. Do you call it a lie or not? Call it a lie. Yeah. You call a spade. So, yes, I hope we don't get there, but please help us. Help yourselves. Help us. Where America goes, the world goes.
Maria Ressa, Nobel Peace Prize winner, thank you so much for your time.
Why didn't the police rush in? That's the question, the anguish today in Uvalde, Texas, 3 days after the slaughter of 19 kids and 2 teachers at Robb Elementary School. Now, the exact timeline of the response is still emerging, but it's clear officers waited around an hour before a specially trained team from the Border Patrol charged in. Rob Copeland is covering this for the Wall Street Journal, and he has just returned to Austin from Uvalde. Rob, welcome.
Thank you.
So first, officials in Uvalde said the shooter was confronted by an armed guard. Now they say there was no guard. The shooter spent 12 minutes outside before going into the school, and it was a full hour before law enforcement charged in and killed him. Why the delay?
Well, the official narrative here has really been in flux from the first moments. I got to Uvalde a few hours after the shooting, and I was in the room with parents of missing children who were asking the police that same evening of the shooting, and the police still didn't know how many kids were dead. They called it an active investigation, and they wouldn't even confirm that the children were missing or not. What we've seen over the past few days is this whole narrative that the shooter was confronted by a school security guard, this narrative that the shooter was chased by police, that none of that ever happened now, according to the police. And it's really unclear what happened in those first 1 hour to 90 minutes.
Is the current guidance for police officers to go in immediately in a case like this?
Generally speaking, the current guidance is that if there's an active shooter, particularly in a place like a school, that you go in and you try to interfere immediately. Now, the extremely unusual thing about this is that the police were there, they were gathering outside, and that it was the Border Patrol who actually wound up entering the school and taking out the shooter. The Border Patrol, although there's a lot of Border Patrol officers who live in the area because it's not too far from the border with Mexico, they really have no responsibility or jurisdiction over the local school. So if you were putting this out in a playbook, you wouldn't have the Border Patrol anywhere near it.
Yeah, okay. And what is the current explanation for how the shooter got in and how easy it seemed to be?
As of yesterday, the police have said that the shooter got in through an open door or an open gate. They've been muddy on what exactly it was in the back of the campus. The school was having an awards day for, you know, best attendance and things like that for students. So they were allowing people onto the campus. Now, at a press conference yesterday, reporters were peppering the police with questions about how exactly one man could barricade himself inside a classroom to the extent that an entire phalanx of police officers couldn't get in, and the police simply would not answer that question.
Oh. As you know, Rob, there are videos that have gone viral of parents outside begging police officers to go in. One woman in the video is heard saying the police are doing nothing. You spoke to a mother who jumped the fence and went into the school to bring her sons out. Can you describe the scene as best you know outside the school during that hour the gunman was inside?
So this is one of the most disturbing parts of this incredibly disturbing story. I spoke to a mother who works as a farm supervisor 40 miles from the school. So she's pretty far away. And when she heard there was a shooter at the school, she jumped in her car and she drove back. By the time she got there, the police still weren't inside the school. Keep in mind, she's driven 40 miles, and she was very agitated, and she was trying to enter. And she says that a U.S. Marshal actually put handcuffs on her and told her she was under arrest for trying to interfere with an investigation. Now, she says that later, a local police officer who knew her got her out of the cuffs. She then made her distance from the crowd, jumped over the fence, ran into two separate classrooms where her children were, grabbed them, and ran them off the campus. This is all before the police have even entered. So she did this all on her own, and the police are still standing around, as she puts it.
Yeah.
Finally, Rob, what are the biggest unanswered questions or things that are still unclear right now?
So one of the major questions is, in this hour to an hour and a half that the police are at the site, but they're not inside the school, was the shooter still shooting? Were there children inside who were alive, who later lost their lives while the police were just feet away? That's something the police have not answered with any clarity. The other question is, the shooter was, as we understand it now, at the school shooting outside at a local funeral home for 12 minutes before the police even began to show up. Now, I was in Uvalde. It's not too big a city. Nothing is more than, say, a mile or two away. And the police have not given an answer why there was that crucial 12 minutes where before the shooter even entered the classroom, they could have arrived at the scene, but they simply didn't.
Rob Copeland of the Wall Street Journal. Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now to Ukraine, where Russia continues to make gradual gains in the east. And there are reports of Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines with very little food or training. Sudarshan Raghavan is in Uman, Ukraine. He is a correspondent with our editorial partners at The Washington Post. Sudarshan, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Peter.
Now, Russia has been focusing on the east, trying to surround cities like Severodonetsk. What is the big picture here? What's happening in the east?
Yeah, that's right. So the Russians, what they're doing now, after failing to take over the capital, Kyiv, and then forced to retreat out of Kharkiv, the second largest city, they've been focusing all their efforts in trying to take over the eastern Donbas region of Ukraine. This region consists of two provinces, the Luhansk and Donetsk, and Severodonetsk is part of Luhansk. The Russians so far have taken nearly all of Luhansk, and their focus at the current moment is trying to take over the city of Severodonetsk. They've been, every day now, there's been massive bombardments in the city. People are essentially living underground. Those who remain, there's roughly about 13 to 15,000 people who remain there, according to the authorities we spoke with. Others, you know, there are daily attempts of trying to evacuate people. The Ukrainian forces are also inside the city and trying to stop the Russian advance. And at the current moment, they've surrounded the city by from three different sides, and a few days ago they actually targeted and took out one of three bridges leading into the city. So now there are less ways of people getting out, and also supplies and reinforcements entering the city.
So at the same time, you're reporting on the struggle of the Ukrainian troops, specifically one group of soldiers in Druzhkivka. You met them at a hotel because they'd left the front lines. Is that right?
That's correct. You know, what they told me was that, you know, they were on the front lines, actually kind of south of Severodonetsk, the city, in a town called Troshkivka. And they, you know, they were essentially civilian volunteers, but they found themselves and their men all thrust onto one of the worst front lines in the war, and they were just not prepared for this. You know, they weren't given enough training, they said. The weaponry was light. They were only given light weapons. They didn't have any of the more heavy weaponry, such as anti-tank missiles. And on top of that, they were sent pretty much to the very front, where they had to dig trenches and be in the trenches. And behind them, you know, in many cases, there wasn't enough support, artillery support, tank support. And so they found themselves pretty much in the being targeted by the Russian forces. And as a result, you know, at least two of their team members have died so far since they've been there, and many more have been injured, while others have just simply refused to fight. And yeah.
And you write that at times they're living on a single potato every single day. I want to play a little piece of tape here from a volunteer soldier in a platoon of the 115th Brigade, 3rd Battalion. In this video uploaded to Telegram, the soldier is describing what life is like in eastern Ukraine.
Нас стріляють просто на віру смерть. Немає ніякого бойового керівництва, жодного бойового команди.
He's saying that they've been waiting for reinforcements for 2 weeks. They're being sent to certain death. They have no battle commanders, no equipment. There's no respect for the soldiers. What do you think, Sudarshan? Are the Ukrainian soldiers finally reaching their limits here?
Well, look, I mean, you know, these are definitely a few units, platoons that are coming out and openly speaking. They're quite distressed of what's happening there. But at the same time, you know, when I asked them, is your morale down? They insist it isn't. They said they want to continue fighting for their country. But the thing is, they lack the support. And what they're seeking is more of such support and more leadership from their superiors so that they're not being sent to certain death.
Well, yeah, and what about those weapons that are supposedly coming into Ukraine from allied countries? Are they not getting to the front lines?
Right. Well, you know what? That is one concern that many Ukrainian soldiers and volunteers have expressed to me. They're just not seeing yet all this promised weaponry that's supposed to be reaching them.
And we've been hearing for weeks, months even, about the problems inside the Russian military. Now we're hearing about the challenges for the Ukrainians. What does this signal to you about how long this war might drag on in the East?
No, that's really hard to tell. The Ukrainians are, you know, in certain areas, they are doing tactical retreats in order to fortify their positions. Then what they hope will be a counteroffensive. Their whole strategy right now is to slow the Russians down so that these heavy weaponry that's been promised by the United States and promised by Europe finally arrives that they can deploy against the Russians. So it's a bit of a, you know, the front lines are constantly shifting in the eastern Donbass. And so it's difficult to predict what's going to happen in the future, save for the fact that I think, you know, most people I've spoken to feel that this war is going to be a grinding one. It's going to go on possibly for months.
Sudarshan Raghavan, correspondent for The Washington Post, joining us from Uman, Ukraine. Sudarshan, thanks so much for your reporting.
Glad to be with you.
The abortion debate is not solely centered on economics, but many women denied the procedure could face enormous financial consequences if Roe v. Wade is overturned. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Like most women seeking an abortion, Brittany Mostiller already had children when she unexpectedly got pregnant again.
I had two young daughters, both under the age of 5, sharing a 2-bedroom apartment with my sister.
And she'd just been laid off from her overnight job as a greeter for Greyhound buses.
All of my unemployment, you know, benefits had to go towards rent, trying to figure out utilities. I'm not even sure I had a cell phone at that point, or if I did, it was certainly on and off.
Mostiller worried about finding another job while pregnant, but mostly she didn't want to sacrifice the well-being of her two children by having a third she simply could not afford. As it turned out, she couldn't afford an abortion either, and in Illinois at that time, 15 years ago, it was not covered by Medicaid. Soon after giving birth to a third daughter, she started work as a cashier but could only get 20 hours a week.
Like defaulting on student loans that I was navigating.
Then she defaulted on credit card payments. At one point, she juggled 3 jobs trying to make it all work. Mostiller's worries about poverty are widely shared among women seeking abortions, and for good reason, says Caitlin Myers, an economist at Middlebury College. She says a large body of research shows being able to access an abortion offers a major boost to women's economic prospects.
Allowing them, in turn, to obtain more education, to enter more professional careers, to avoid poverty, and also providing those same economic advantages to the children that they parented later.
In the abortion case before the Supreme Court, Myers spearheaded an amicus brief by 154 economists, but she says their findings seem to have been ignored. In fact, the leaked draft opinion by Justice Samuel Alito cites arguments by abortion opponents that it's easier now to get benefits like paid leave. Myers says that's just not true for most women seeking abortions.
This population of women is disproportionately poor, lacks access to paid parental leave, lacks access to affordable child care, even if they can schedule the child care, because a lot of these women work in what's called shift work with very irregular schedules that make obtaining child care very difficult.
Of course, abortion opponents see all this differently. When Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told a recent Senate panel that overturning Roe would set women back decades, she drew this rebuke from South Carolina Republican Tim Scott.
Did you say that ending the life of a child is good for the labor force participation rate?
He called it harsh to frame the painful reality of abortion that way. Plus,
I'll just simply say that as a guy raised by a black woman in abject poverty, I'm thankful to be here as a United States senator.
But his success story is not the norm when those who seek an abortion are denied one. Economist Jason Lindo with Texas A&M University says the financial fallout extends well into the lives of such women's children.
There is a huge empirical literature showing that there are detrimental effects on these kids' outcomes. When they grow up, they're less likely to attain higher education themselves. They're more likely to be involved in crime, have lower adult earnings.
He says cutting off abortion access for more people would mean widening already stark economic disparities for generations to come. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
If you're in the market for a new or used car, you better hold on to that handle thingy above the passenger window. It's bumpy out there. The nation's largest online used car retailer, Carvana, based here in Arizona, has seen its shares fall nearly 90% since November, and it recently laid off thousands of employees. There haven't been enough new cars to meet demand, and that's been wreaking havoc on the car market for a while now. Michelle Krebs is executive analyst at Cox Automotive. Michelle, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
And why don't we start with Carvana? The stock has plummeted. There have been layoffs. What's wrong?
I'm not a financial analyst, but I will say that Carvana has been on a big growth route, and it's been very successful. But it's hit this confluence of factors in the market that is hampering it right now. The used car market is really hot, and it's costing companies like Carvana that sell used cars a lot to acquire them. And there's tremendous competition for used vehicles.
Oh, interesting. You know, I was surprised to hear this news because I've been hearing about all this pent-up demand for cars. As you say, used car prices have gone up so much, you'd think this would be a good time for business.
Well, it is, except there's such a competition for used vehicles because a lot of people are frozen out of the new car market. One, because of high prices, they just can't afford them. And also, there's really low inventory because of the chip shortage and COVID lockdowns in China. It has really hampered production for the automakers. So a lot of people are turning to the used car market for a vehicle. So there are more people that are looking for used vehicles. The other thing that happened is rental car companies can't buy cars from the new car producers, so they are turning to the used car market for their rental car fleets. So there's a lot of competition to buy used vehicles.
Why not? Because they don't have the cars, or they're just too much money?
They've got so much retail demand that automakers are focused on the retail customer. And so they aren't selling to commercial fleets as much, and they aren't selling to daily rental car companies as much because that's not as profitable a business.
Is this just about Carvana, or do you think possibly the idea of buying a used car online is still a little bit ahead of its time?
Oh, I don't think so. This isn't unique to Carvana, although they are the big guy and they have been expanding the fastest. No, I think that online buying is here to stay. We know from our surveys that consumers of both new and used cars want to do more, if not all, of the buying process online. We've seen a great increase of that since COVID. So that's not going away. It's just a matter of where these companies get the cars, the kind of competition they face, and the prices they are paying, and then what they can get for those cars when they sell them to consumers.
All right, let's take a moment to talk about inflation. How much higher can prices for used cars realistically go?
Well, I think that we're starting to see price increase growth slow. Our data shows that the typical asking price for a used vehicle is around $28,000 now. That was hit a record in December, and we're about at that point. But we do anticipate that should come down a bit. But prices are still going to be high for used cars and new cars.
We've talked about rising interest rates putting a crimp on the demand for housing. Is it doing the same for cars?
Not yet, but it certainly will. You know, cars are something you just have to have, so you have to just bite the bullet. But we are seeing auto loan rates go up, and of course that adds to the monthly payment, and that may cause some people to just stay away from buying a new or used vehicle.
Well, one of the big problems has been the supply chain issues that have caused headaches not only in the automotive industry, but across the economy. There's also this chip shortage that is affecting the auto industry. Have you seen any signs that those are starting to ease at all?
Well, we haven't seen it in the numbers of vehicle inventory for new cars. That's still just stuck in low gear. And we're getting mixed signals from executives at various companies. This week, Volkswagen CEO said that he thought that they are seeing improvement. But then I saw a quote from Intel CEO saying, we're only halfway through this chip shortage. And then we can never predict things like the COVID lockdowns in China, which are stalling some parts as well.
In the meantime, I don't envy anyone who's trying to buy a car in this market. What do you suggest people do?
Well, I don't envy them either. I think they need to think about, do they really need a car? I mean, some people absolutely do. They've had an accident or the car has just died. They have to shop more than they ever did before. They have to expand their geographic search, check a dealer farther away. They may not be able to get exactly what they want. They've got to be really flexible in terms of the brand they buy, the features they have on that. It's just, it takes patience, persistence, and flexibility.
Is it as tough to find a new car as it is a used car?
Used car is actually easier. The supply of used cars is actually better than that of new. So that may be an option for people who are looking for a new car.
But they're not cheap. Michelle Krebs, executive analyst at Cox Automotive. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Okay, from the road to the skies we go. In this country, 6% of professional pilots are women. One of them is Dolina Fox. She's a commercial pilot in Alaska, and she's a member of the Yupik Indigenous community. Olivia Eberts of member station KYUK introduces her.
All right, you ready?
Yep.
Let's roll.
Pacific Rough on the roll, there too.
Dolina Fox is flying a 1975 silver and blue striped Cessna 207 to the Alaska Native village Tuntutuliak. At 26 years old, Fox is about two decades younger than her six-seater airplane. It's the end of Fox's first two-week shift as a commercial pilot for regional airline Grant Aviation. She shuttles around cargo and passengers between traditional Upiat villages in Alaska's Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and the region's hub city of Bethel.
Yeah, go ahead.
1 minute. Fox grew up between two of these villages. She remembers being excited by the idea of flying back when she was in middle school, when she flew with a female pilot for the first time.
That's kind of like where it felt real, like it's achievable, you know?
Only five of Grant Aviation's 60 pilots are female. But Fox has another role model, too.
Are you proud?
Why wouldn't I be? Yeah, sure am.
That's Delina's uncle, Andy Fox. He's worked on and off for the airlines for nearly 50 years. Andy and Delina are two of Grant's five Yupik pilots. But Delina is the very first female Yupik pilot to work for Grant. She took the leap when she lost her job selling tickets for another airline during the pandemic.
And I was like, well, I'm just going to go for it. So I did. I moved to Anchorage and I went to flight training.
Less than 2 years later, she had her private pilot's license, her instructor certification, and her commercial pilot's license. After we land in Tuntutuliak, Fox unloads her cargo, passing each box to the gate agent. There's a box with a grocery store sheet cake and another with blue sprinkled cupcakes. It's someone's birthday in Tuntutuliak. The agent swaps the cargo for passengers, a girl and her mom. Fox greets them and takes their luggage. While they board the plane, the girl's dad, Andrew Frank, says it's incredible to have a pilot in the YK Delta who can communicate Yuktun with them.
It's always very impressive and make us very proud that we see native pilots and elders that don't know how to speak English can always talk to them.
Fox says she didn't always think her dream of shuttling Yupik-speaking passengers was a reality.
For me personally, it was really hard to even just leave Bethel to go to flight training and to go to school and to do something that I never saw as a successful goal. And I want more people to know that doing what they want to do is actually very achievable.
Now, Fox wants to help other locals learn to fly too. That's why she made it a point to get her instructor's certificate. As for what's next for Fox, she says she may move on to larger aircraft one day, but for now, she's content to fly in her home region.
I feel like everything I have on the ground dissipates. Keeping the plane in the air, that's all I have to care for, you know? So everything else, like all my problems or all my things I need to do in life, is left on the ground when I take off.
Left side Delta, cross one left side Delta behind Cherokee, 7 for Alpha, taxi via Charlie.
For Here and Now, I'm Olivia Eberts.
After 3 years, the long-awaited fourth season of Stranger Things on Netflix comes out today. And if you haven't watched, here's the big reveal. The episodes are long. Each is over 1 hour. And the finale in July, 2.5 hours. It's like a movie. Well, except movies are now often a 3-hour experience. That may be good for creators, unburdened by, say, a TV broadcast schedule. But what about us, the viewers? Let's put that to Daniel Luria. He's editorial director of Box Office Pro, a publication that follows movie release trends. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Daniel, we're seeing streaming shows, in some cases, that are getting longer, sometimes movies getting a lot longer, and at the same time, these TikTok videos getting a lot shorter. So what's going on? Is the industry having space to experiment here?
Yeah, Scott, I think everyone in the entertainment industry is trying to figure out how to best optimize the content going on their screens for their platforms. That's a specific challenge for companies like TikTok and Netflix that have a very defined, say, insular audience base.
Yeah.
But a lot harder for big movie studios like Disney or like Paramount that not only release movies to movie theaters as big spectacles, but also have to think about how those movies play in their own streaming channels like Paramount mm-hmm. Plus or Disney Plus back at the home. Yeah. Everyone's trying to figure out what works best where.
Okay. And then how about streaming shows like Stranger Things on Netflix? What's the idea there, I guess, requiring, at least from a creative point of view, that it to be longer than a lot of streaming shows that are out there?
Well, when we talk about subscription video on demand services like Netflix, we're talking about an economic model where you don't have to rely on these commercial breaks to structure your shows around or even structure your entire narrative arcs across a series of episodes. They have the freedom to experiment, go a little bit longer one week, go a lot longer the next week. Mm. Meanwhile, Netflix has a lot of movies in their service, and I think viewers are used to sitting down and binging 6 episodes back to back to back. So yes, even if the episodes seem like they are getting longer, I'm sure Netflix is also looking at their viewership data and realizing, well, we're talking about viewers that might be watching 2 or 3 episodes back to back. So we still get them for 2 to 3 hours. How can we make the best out of that viewership data and optimize that with episode lengths?
And so for us, the consumer, should we just get used to not knowing how long something is going to go, right? You know, in shorthand, we talk about movie length, and for a while, we kind of knew what we were talking about, streaming show length. We kind of knew. Should we not assume anymore?
I think fortunately, we have a trusty ally like Google that very simply tells us what we're in for whenever we go somewhere, right?
Yeah.
I think it's really down to consumers realizing where they want to spend their viewing time. For me, I'm a big fan of sitting down and watching something in a movie theater that has my undivided attention. It's really difficult for me to watch a movie at home without distractions, without my phone, without, you know, another screen going off. I like that experience of going to the movies, and some movies are going and leaning into that and pushing that captive attention a little bit further with their running times, right? And then in other instances, when I think about TV shows that are maybe 20 to 30 minutes long, like the classic sitcom, that actually works perfectly on my TV. And finally, when I think about having my phone around everywhere, for me, Instagram, TikTok, nothing more than 2 or 3 minutes per piece of content. Mm. I can't imagine watching too much of anything else on my phone. Right now, as consumers, we have the freedom to decide what we want to see, where we want to see it.
Yeah. And Daniel, finally, just to come back to this Netflix example, is Stranger Things an example, a possible example for Netflix that, you know, they know that their audience doesn't mind longer content and they can put it out there, see how it goes, test it?
Netflix has data on viewership trends that is theirs and theirs alone. Mm. It's the sort of company that will always make decisions based on those insights that they've learned of years and years of consumer trends on what they have on their screens. So yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting evolution going forward, especially as we have learned very recently from the last quarterly earnings calls from Netflix, in that maybe down the line, they'll have to open an ad-supported tier to their platform, the way we've seen with other streaming companies, like Hulu, for example.
Yeah.
If that comes in, that might change this entire equation, right? So that quarterly investor call, that subscriber number, I think that might dictate things like show length and what gets made in the future for Netflix more than anything else.
Okay. Well, we got a clock, so we got to go. Daniel Luria is editorial director at Box Office Pro. Daniel, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. Have a good holiday weekend if you can. It's Here and Now.